Let's get started. It's the 27th of January, and it's our second presentation. And we're going to be continuing our introduction to investments by going now down a little bit, about 30,000 feet, and looking over the landscape. And then we'll discuss a little bit of risk versus return. But first, we need a good joke. Anybody got a good joke? Not good? I got plenty of bad jokes.
Okay, there's three squirrels on a tree. Three squirrels on a tree.
Okay.
One was trying to get a nut, so he threw himself and fell and died. The other one was hanging from his tail. He slipped and fell and died. The third one thought they were all playing a game, so he threw himself and fell and died.
And that's a joke?
Yeah.
In what culture?
In every culture.
In every culture. Okay. Well, I heard an Iranian joke once, and remember, every culture is different. The bank robbers were going to rob the bank, but then it was Sunday, and that's funny in Iran, you know. So. How about a stock market joke? How do you make a small fortune in the stock market? You start.
I did that in the last class.
I didn't tell you about the alligator that walked into the bar.
Yeah.
I did. Okay, forget it. Okay, I'm striking out this morning. Sorry, my apologies. I'm talking funny because I went to the dentist. All right, so let's continue. You have your handouts from Tuesday, Thursday. You don't need them. That's the other class. I'm getting confused. But here is the assignment sheet, notes sheet. For chapter one, so I'll pass that out. And every chapter, I give you it's on the website, of course, a handout, notes, assignment sheet, which has the terms that you need to study. This is your study guide. And people say, well, do I have to know all of them? I say, yeah, you should know all of them, except every once in a while I'll say, you know, ignore this. Like, for example, geometric average returns. You don't have to worry about those. We're going to ignore those. They're in the book if you want to learn about them. But we're going to ignore those. So let's couple of slides on return and risk, and we'll come back to it. Return is straightforward to measure. How much did you start with? How much did you end? That's your return. The total dollar return is important because it shows us how much we made. But more importantly, we want to take a look at the percentage. The percentage return on all the cash flows, the money coming in, and the capital gains or losses. Why? Because that allows us to compare how well our investments are doing vis-a-vis other investments. So the percentage return is what we're going to key on, and realize that the more money we have, the more percentage return gives us a greater dollar return. But the dollar return is important, right? We'll discuss that when we take a look at cash flows in particular. But risk is a totally different problem, total different world, because risk is very difficult to measure. And we said that risk, when we think of risk, we think of danger and harm. But that's not the way we think of them in the financial world, because it's really impossible to predict that. What we do is we take a look at the standard deviation. And if you had statistics and you are ready to run out the door, don't worry. We don't have to calculate it. All we have to do is look it up. And the history is there for us to look up. That measures what's called the volatility. Because in any given year, there's about a two-thirds chance that the return of investment will be within one standard deviation of the historical average return by, relax. We'll come back to this in a minute. Oh, not a minute. We'll come back to this in about 30 minutes. The higher the standard deviation, all you have to know for now, the more volatile, the more the investment bumps up and down. So now, what we're going to do is a short overview. And some of you, this is going to be review. I apologize, but it bears repeating. We're going to take a look at each of these in not much detail. And so whatever you've learned from the... Am I going too fast? No? Whatever you've learned from the television or the internet, just throw it away. Because all I want you to know for chapter one is what's in here. First one are equities. And you got to learn that word because now you're a guru, you're an expert, because the experts don't say stocks, they say equities. Are you in equities these days? Oh, yes, of course. But equity is just another word for ownership, isn't it? Ownership. Any accounting majors, right? Any accountants in here? What is equity? It's what we own. Equity is what we own. And that's why they're called equities. Because when you invest in stocks, specifically common stocks, and I know it's a bad word because people say, oh, I don't want common. It's like, no, it has nothing to do with that. You are part owner in the corporation. And why would you want to do this? Well, because you're going to receive optionally dividends and capital gains. They are optional. They are not guaranteed. And for this reason, we say that stocks are volatile. And so you're going to hear that term often when you, in the investment world, you're going to hear it in here. And it is a euphemism. You know what a euphemism is? Euphemism is when you say, girls, let's go powder our noses. It means you're going to the bathroom, right? It's saying one word and meaning something else. So in the investment world, when you say an investment was volatile, it means I lost my shirt. How was that stock you bought? Oh, it's been very volatile. That means they bought it for $8 and it's selling for 30 cents or something. You're not laughing. It ain't funny, is it? Not for the person that it happened to. So yes, stocks are volatile. And one of the things we don't discuss often when we discuss stocks is the limited liability nature of stocks. The business people, if you've taken Business 120 or if you're in business, you know that if you're in business for yourself and you're in a sole proprietor or a partnership, you and the business are one and the same. So that if the business gets in trouble, who's in trouble? You are. If you invest in a corporation and the corporation gets in trouble, you're off the hook. Once you've lost all your money, they can't come after you and say, you know what, you still owe us another $100,000. So we call that limited liability. And it's one thing we don't really discuss when we don't think about stocks, but it's something you should know. If you buy some stocks and they become worthless, that's it. You lost your money, but they're not going to come after you. If anybody taking Business 120 yet? 129? No? One? Yeah. One or two? Okay, you discuss this in detail, right? Now, over the long term, stocks have had the best historical return of the major financial classes. I don't tell people 8 to 12. I tell them 8 to 10. 8, 9, 10%. They should be considered a long-term investment. Now let's take a look at the 2008 definition. Stocks are equity investment instruments designed to lose value. How long ago was 2008? No, it's 7, 8 years ago, right? And yet we're still shaking. Some investors are still shaking from that thunderbolt from the sky where stocks lost 40, 50, 60%, some depending on which ones you invested in. The next category is fixed income. And again, that's the name you're going to use now because you are all gurus, but everybody else uses bonds and they don't know what they're saying. And in reality, all they are loans, IOUs. Corporations, when they borrow money, do they go to a bank? Sometimes, but normally when they have big ticket items, when they want to build a whole new plant or they want to move into another country, they need to borrow massive sums of money. They issue bonds, which means they're borrowing money. Investors buy those bonds. The same thing is true for state and local governments, municipal bonds. When we built that stadium, did we do a bake sale to do that stadium? No, we sold bonds, and now we have to pay those things over the next 30 years, like a mortgage. And then the federal government. Bond investors, if you're a bond investor, you are playing the part of the bank, and you're lending your money to the bond issuer, the corporation, the state, the local municipality, the treasury. The bond investors then receive interest payments, and they receive, there's a promise to get their principal back. Now, unlike dividends and capital gains, these are not optional, folks. The issuer has signed a contract, like a mortgage, saying they are going to pay that back. Now, do they always pay it back? Most of the time, do people mostly pay their credit cards, mostly pay their car loans, mostly pay their mortgages? Not 2008, 9, 10. Most of the time, bond investors are going to get their money back. So we find that bonds are much less riskier than stocks. They are less volatile. But because you're getting less volatility, what are you going to get? More return or less return? Everyone should say less return. You're going to get less? Yeah, you're going to get less return. And in general, in return for that lesser volatility, you get anywhere from 4 to 8%. Now, at this point in time, are bonds paying 4 to 8%? The answer is no. They're paying much less, 2 to 5%. 5% is a big yield for bonds these days. So right now, bonds are paying the low end. But over the long sweep of time, this is what we get. Yes, Vicki? Well, if you buy the bond, you're playing the part of the bank. Do you see? When you go to the bank lends you money. And what do you got to do? You got to pay it back with interest. So the corporation, the municipal government, says, we want to make a loan. So they sell the bond. And if you're the bond investor, you buy the bond. So you're lending them money. So we don't use the term equity, do we? We sometimes use the word debt. Or fixed income. Because now we know, and if all goes well, and it should, the issuer, the corporation, the local government, the federal government, is going to pay us interest payments periodically and then pay us back our principal. So when you buy a bond, it's a little tricky, isn't it? Because you don't think of a loan as something that's an investment. You know, well, it is. Not from the person who's making the loan. That's a debt for them. But from the person or the entity that is lending them the money, that loan is now an asset. It's an investment. And that's what's on, that's why when you work in a bank, everything's backwards. Everything, you think of a loan as a debt. No, the bank says, no, that's our assets. That's what we own. And we know that most people are going, we check their credit score, they're going to pay us back. So when you buy a bond, you're playing the part of the bank. Make sense? We'll spend about 2 or 3 weeks in detail on bonds. But the truth is bonds are pretty darn boring, folks. Yeah. But they're important. They're important. Because if you can't make a loan to buy a house, how are you going to build that house? Go down to Mexico, and people and Americans, they go, it's getting better. It's getting much better. But Americans go down to Mexico, and they go, why are all these buildings in several different states of houses are being built? It's so funny. Like one of them's got the floor, the other one's got some walls, the other one's got half the... Why? It is very difficult to get a loan in Mexico from a bank to build a house. So what they do is they save up some money, and then they put the floor to the foundation down. Then they save up some more money, and they put the walls up. And you see, because they... It's getting better. The banks and are getting nice. People in Mexico don't trust the banks. The banks have screwed them over several times, so they don't trust them. But so the same thing is true for corporations. If they can't borrow the money, they can't get from point A to point B. And sometimes the federal government, can you imagine them holding a bake sale to invade Iraq? We need $900 billion to, you know. They sold bonds, and we bought them. Okay, so 2008 definition. Bonds are fixed-rate investment instruments designed to lose value. Did bonds lose value in 2008? Yeah. Why? Because the Great Recession hit hard. Corporations, local municipalities, and many of them just couldn't pay their debts. So what did the investors do? They sold the bonds, the prices fell, and if you held on, you watched the value of your investment go down. Now that was not true of Treasury bonds. Treasury bonds actually went up, and that's called the flight to quality. Because people were so worried, they bought treasury bonds because they felt that the U.S. government is always going to be there. Do you believe that the U.S. government is always going to pay their debts? No? Let me disabuse you of that, okay? It will. You know, someday we're going to all die. But okay. Now, short-term investments. Short-term investments are sometimes euphemistically referred to as cash. But the proper term is short-term instruments, short-term vehicles, short-term investments. And these you can think of as a place to park your money. A place to park your money because you ain't going to lose the principal. You're not going to lose value. They are usually guaranteed or pretty darn close. They're very liquid. Some of them let you write a check or just transfer it into your checking account. Very low risk of losing principal. So if we have a low risk investment, what kind of return are we going to get? Everyone should say pitiful, low. Come on in. And so that's exactly what happens with these things. When we have a guaranteed safe return, we can expect a very low, guaranteed safe investment, low risk, we're almost guaranteed a low return. And over the long period of time, they've paid anywhere from 2 to 5%. What are they paying now? Less, far less, 0.2%, 0.01%, some of them. I think it's a joke. You know, why give me 3 cents? Thank you so much. We also use these for an emergency fund. Now, let's see what the 2008 definition was. Short-term investments are instruments designed to accept what remains of investors' money after they've given up on stocks and bonds. Was that a good time to sell in 2008-09? So why did everybody do it if it wasn't a good time to sell? Because there's two parts of investing, an intellectual part and an emotional part. And after your $10,000 becomes $6,000, you're ready to say, no mas, no mas. And so you pull everything out at the worst possible time and put it into the money market, put it into the savings account. Bad idea. And here are just some of the examples. Don't try to write them down because we're going to go over these again. And later on Thursday, we will spend a day and get short-term investments out of the way because they're relatively easy and they're just used to park your money. Now, the next category, the next asset class are mutual funds. Mutual funds, the term is bad. You know, I really hate that term, but, you know, nothing I can do to change it. The legal term is investment company. This is what I like to use. But the only time you will hear anybody use the legal term is if you're in the industry, when you're taking the Series 7 or you're in this industry, because everybody calls them mutual funds. This is a company that pools investors' money and invests in a diversified portfolio of securities. Investors get two wonderful things. Diversification, which gives you some protection in case something goes wrong with an individual security, with an individual stock, with an individual bond. And you get professional money management. Now, these sometimes get a bad rap. Sometimes deservedly so, and sometimes non-deservedly so. These people are paid a tremendous sum of money to do a good job. The problem is, it ain't easy. And there are very good professional money managers out there, and there are not so very good professional money managers out there. And we will do our best to learn to help you learn how to identify good long-term professional money managers. And they're incredibly popular, folks. Chances are, when you go out to the great economic machine out there and plug in, you're going to be offered an employer-sponsored plan where you'll be able to invest your dollars from your paycheck into this retirement plan. And most all of them use mutual funds for the investment. Questions? Am I going too fast? Okay. Making sense? Okay. Just go like this. You don't have to say a word. Just go, help. Don't say help. Just go like that. They range from low risk to speculative. And in 2008, yeah, them too. They went down too because they invested in the stocks and the bonds, and yeah, so they went down too. And this is a graph that I made. Aren't you proud of me? Yeah? Well, I'm proud of me. Oh, by the way, I forgot to pass these around. Take an A, a B, a C, and a D. Okay? Take an A, a B, a C, and a D. And pass them on. We are the little people, and we take our $50, $100, more if we have it, and we give it to the people in the top hats. They're the professional money managers, and more of them are women, which is a good thing, because it turns out that women are better investors, men. Sorry, guys, it's already been shown statistically. Now I'll leave it to you to think about why that is. But luckily, women are getting into the industry. 50 years ago, a woman in the industry was very, very rare. And I had some conversations with some of them who used to be in the industry, and they would tell you horror stories about how they were treated. I mean, you just think of the worst way you could treat a woman, and that's how they were treated. And that's still going on in some quarters. So approximately 50% of American households own mutual funds, or they used to. It's actually down to about 40-some percent now. But these people create this pool of money because there are millions of people sending billions of dollars here. And then what they do with that money is they invest in the stocks, or they invest in the bonds, or the short-term instruments. And, of course, they have a ton of money to invest, so they don't buy 5 stocks or 10 stocks. They buy 200 stocks or 200 bonds. Some of them fewer, some of them more. And so you get this diversification. So if one company turns out to be Kodak, you ever heard of Kodak? You've never heard of Kodak? Some of you have heard of Kodak, yeah. The name will last for a long, long time, but the company's already been through bankruptcy. They used to make film. Remember film? Some of you don't remember film. It used to be one of the biggest companies in the country, and not anymore. So if one company goes Kodak, then the others, you know, still you don't get destroyed. And the same thing is true for the bonds. If one company goes bankrupt and can't pay their debts, it doesn't destroy your entire overall portfolio. And what we see here is that there are many types of mutual funds, which we'll start taking a look at next week. And this one was one of the first. Hybrid, that or a combination, that invests both in stocks and bonds, a balanced fund. Now, the interesting thing about money market mutual funds is that you very rarely hear people say money market mutual funds. They will mostly just say money market. They mean money market mutual funds. And there are money market accounts at banks and credit unions, so it gets a little confusing. So you will just hear people say money market. You got your money in the stock market? No, it's all in a money market. It's all in short-term investments that are not going to lose value but are not going to return very much money to me. Our next seg. Now, these are the four. These are the four that are the most important, in my humble opinion, folks. For us, that's what we're going to key on. The next category is called hybrid investments. And there are many types. But the ones we will spend just a little bit of time later on in the semester are preferred stock and convertible preferred stock and convertible bonds. And don't they sound sexy? Convertibles, preferred. Wouldn't you rather have preferred stock than plain old common stock? And the answer is no. No, you don't want preferred stock. And we'll discuss that later on. Maybe you'll get involved in that world, and maybe not. And what these things are a hybrid. They have one foot in one world and another foot in another world. I got to get this going a little faster here. Here, you take that. Okay, so I'm going to give you guys some of these because we're going to be needing these in just a bit. We've got to get parallel processing going here. Okay, and then start over here. Get a little move on. Hybrid investments are designed to offer the stability of fixed income instruments, bonds, the stability, the less volatility, while having the opportunity for capital growth of equity investments, stocks, the equities. Right here. Okay, have a seat right there. And the truth is that yeah, they have the advantages of both, but they also have the disadvantages of both. Nothing's free, folks. And for the vast majority of us, they really don't make a whole lot of sense. We'll discuss these later on in detail. But for now, all you have to know is what's right here. Make sense? You don't have to know anything else than what we see up here. Now, there are a few other popular investment vehicles, and we'll spend a little bit of time on these at the end of the semester. But, dear students, real estate is a world unto itself. Real estate is very different from all the other types of investments, and we have classes in real estate. And we'll spend a little bit of time at the end. If you want to do more, and we have time, you can contact me. We can do it as a group, or contact me individually, and we can learn some of the tricks of the trade. But real estate, I got to tell you, I have a profound appreciation for securities after having dealing with real estate. Tangible assets such as gold and precious metals and jewels and arts and collectibles. For the vast majority of us, no. You might get involved in this world, in which case I wish you a lot of luck, but no. And then once you are super rich, once you're billionaire rich, tax advantage investments can be very lucrative. But for the vast majority of us working grunts, trading our life for our paycheck for the rent, the mortgage, no, they just don't make a whole lot of sense. Oh, by the way, none of these were spared in 2008. People would say to me, well, aren't you upset the market's lost 50%? I said, well, I'm not happy about it. But the real estate investors lost 100%, and they're still on the hook for a couple $100,000 that they don't have. So real estate got destroyed in 2008 and 2009. The last category is derivatives. We will wait until the very end of the semester before we discuss these in detail. All, again, you need to know is what's on this screen. What we need to know about, notice the question marks. A lot of people in the industry, including myself, do not categorize these as investments. They are speculations. Speculative securities means they can be bought and sold and traded that derive their value from an underlying security or what? They're not the asset. They derive their value from another asset? Yeah, that's how it works. And it's very tricky, and it's very confusing, and it's very dangerous. So all you have to know is that these things are dangerous. And you can, if you want to, you should, remember that the two major categories of derivatives are options and futures. But there are many others. The derivative speculators did not feel so all alone in 2008. Because they're usually the only ones who've lost 30 or 40% of their money. When they saw everybody else losing 30 or 40%, they said, oh, we're about even with everybody else. That's a joke. Okay, so what are our emphases in this class? We're going to emphasize stocks. We're going to spend 4, 5, 6 weeks on stocks. Because that's where the action is, folks. Couple of weeks on bonds, boring, stodgy, reliable bonds. Short-term securities, Thursday, and then we're done. All we need to know is that they're always available for us when we need something safe for the next 6 months or a year. And then mutual funds. We'll spend a couple weeks on mutual funds starting next week. Some people and some books put mutual funds after you discuss stocks and bonds, which makes some sense. But others, myself and our book, put it before, and that makes some sense too. And in fact, I think it makes more sense because we know, and this is not, I'm not proud of this, folks, but we know many of you are going to disappear after 3, 4, 5 weeks. And so if there's anything you need to learn from this class, it's the next few weeks when we go through mutual funds. So if you can at least stick with us till the first exam, all right? And then you can go drop. Ricardo, question? Well, what would you call scalping? It's speculation, isn't it? It's not investing. Because what you're trying to do is buy something at $10 and sell it for $20. You're not going to hold on to it. Because once the ticket, it's worthless after the next day. So it's a method of speculation. We'll discuss speculating versus investing today as I stop blowing off my mouth here. So for the vast majority of investors, these are the most popular and most important financial investment options. Cool? You with me? All right. Now, I give you these ABCD cards because we're Southwestern and we're poor and we don't have the electronics that many other companies have, or many other schools have. Anybody go to the state? San Diego State? You got the push button? Yeah. This is an attempt to mimic that for a whole lot less money. And so this is called checking for comprehension. Thank you. What are investment companies that pool investors' money and invest in a diversified portfolio of securities? Investors get diversification and professional money management. Oh, what a great class. Look at all those D's. Exactly. And so this is also an example of the kind of questions you will see on my exams. My questions, the true, false, the multiple choice, I try to make as straightforward as possible. I don't try to trick you. Unless I say, this is tricky, I'll tell you. You'll get the idea. You'll know this is tricky. Investment company is the legal term. Mutual fund is the popular term. The next category are investments that represent ownership in a corporation. Investors receive dividends and capital gains or capital losses. Hybrid securities, common stocks, bonds, short-term securities. Look at all those B's. Right, stocks. When people use the term stocks, they are almost always talking about common stocks. So this is all you have to know about stocks. You understand? Later on, we're going to learn a whole lot more. And this is what you would tell somebody. If somebody said, well, why do you invest in stocks? You wouldn't start going into all the things that we learn here near the middle of the semester because you're just going to confuse them. Just tell them, well, you're owning a corporation. You're owning a business. You're part owner. And the business can optionally pay you dividends, money in your pocket. And you hope that the business grows and the stock goes up. But it could go down. You with me? It's like peeling an onion, and we're on the outer layer. Or, I don't know if that analogy works. I like the analogy where you're flying down lower, and you can see more of the landscape. I don't know if that works either, but whatever. We're going to learn more as we go along. And then, what are investments with very little risk and correspondingly very little return often used as the place to park your money or for an emergency fund of 3, 6, 9 months income, hybrid securities, common stocks, bonds, short-term securities? Come on, you're going to have to be right. I'm not grading you. Right, D. And low risk, low return. Ain't no way to get around that, folks. Low risk, low return. And then lastly, what are fixed income securities that represent loans to corporations, municipalities, state and local governments, and the federal government? Investors receive interest and a promise to repay the loan. There's bonds. I think there's one more, actually. Bonds. Bonds are fixed income. We know how much we're going to get, assuming they don't go into default, into bankruptcy. And now here's the list. What are securities designed to offer the stability of fixed income investments? Maybe not. With the opportunity for capital growth of equity instruments. And examples include preferred stock and convertible bonds. Derivatives, common stocks, bonds, and hybrid securities. Come on over here. We need some people over here. No, these are hybrids. These are hybrids, not derivatives. We'll get to derivatives. The best and the worst of both worlds. So that's all you have to know about hybrid securities. And then here's the last one. I promise. Here's the last one. What are speculative securities that derive their value from an underlying security or asset? Examples include options contracts and futures contracts. Those are derivatives. They derive their value from something else. You can make a whole lot of money. You can lose a whole lot of money. You'll see people say, oh, I made 100% on my option. And the next day I lost 100%. So it went up, it doubled in value, and then became zero in 2 days. Can that happen in the derivative world? It happens all the time. Okay, so now what are reasonable long-term expectations of returns from the following investments? This is not A, B, C, or D. Stocks? What do you tell people? 8 to 10. Don't tell them 12. You're right if you say 8 to 12, but tell them 8 to 10. How about bonds? Whoops. Am I doing this right? Yeah, bonds. 4 to 8, but right now what do you tell them? You're not going to get 4 to 8 right now. You're lucky if you get 5. 5 is very risky. How about short-term security? Short-term security? 2 to 5? You're going to get 2 to 5 now? No. Mutual funds? Depends on which one you invest in. Hybrid securities? We'll discuss those later. And how about derivatives? Negative something. Okay, excellent. So now let us take a look at investment returns and risk in detail. How much time do we have? Enough time to go through it, I hope. If not, we'll finish it up on Thursday, but I think we will, because this, dear students, is the entire course in 30 minutes. Because if you don't understand risk versus return, you are flying blind. You are simply just listening to somebody else say, well, I invested here. Great, I'll invest there. What's the risk return profile? I don't know. I don't even know what you're talking about. There is no such thing as a free lunch. Have you heard that from the economics professors? Well, it is true in the investment world. Over the long term, equities, and we're going to leave out real estate because real estate's a whole other world, folks. Over the long term, equities have produced the best returns. Over time, 8 to 12%. And again, I usually tell people 8 to 10. Don't get them too excited. Fixed income securities have returned 4, 5, 6 for the Treasury's new muni bonds. They're now returning 2. Corporate bonds have returned 6 to 8. They're now returning 3, 4, 5. And short-term investments have returned 2 to 5. They're now returning 0.2. Mutual funds were more or less, often less, reflect what they invest in, the stocks, the bonds, or the short-term investments. So here is from your book. This is from the 6th edition. I'm sorry. No, this is the 7th. I stole it from the 7th. If you have the 4th, the 5th, the 6th, it just doesn't go as far, all right? But it's the same idea. And we go back to 1926. And ignore small company stocks. Just ignore them because there's a problem with the data on small company stocks. But which one's done the best over the long term? Bonds? Bonds? Here's bonds right here. Stocks. Yeah, ignore this guy because that's way too high. Even the people who create this data will tell you there's a problem with small company stock data because you're dealing with companies that survived. The ones who didn't survive? That's zero, right? That's zero. So we call it survivorship bias. The ones that survived are the ones that get included in the data. The ones that didn't survive, I'm sorry. So ignore small company stocks. But realize that they do better than large company stocks, are riskier. But look at the difference between stocks and bonds. From looking at these numbers, does it look like it should be that big a deal? No. That's because of compound return, compound interest. And Marco, I don't have a seat for you, so you're going to have to standing room only for the next few minutes. Treasury bills, short-term investments, have barely kept up with inflation. They have beaten inflation, but not by much. That's why when you grow up, you want to be a bank. Okay? Because you take in money, give people 2, 3%, now 0.2%, and you turn around and lend it at 18% for their credit cards. You want to be a bank when you grow up. And then if we extend the time horizon, it becomes ludicrous. You know, $1 in stocks over the last 200 and some odd years has become $14 million. Bonds haven't done badly, but you see this is called opportunity cost for you economics fans. Treasury bills, and look at gold. Gold has bounced around, but it's done better than inflation, but then it hasn't done as well as short-term investments. We will discuss gold later on. And if you are raring to go about gold, you go on to invest in gold, come see me because we won't get it till the end of the semester. And I'll do my best to show you that it is a silly investment. A silly investment. Beautiful, though. Beautiful. Buy a coin and hang it up somewhere. It's really gorgeous. But it's not a good investment. It is no accident that stocks and bonds have produced better returns than short-term investments. It's no accident, folks. Because if you could get the same kind of return from short-term investments with far less risk, would you bother to invest in a company knowing that you could lose a lot of money? You wouldn't do it. So you would assume the risk-free rate of return. And that's the return on guaranteed short-term investments. And specifically, the investment world uses the return on U.S. Treasury bills. Now, what are those? We'll discuss those on Thursday. But those are the short-term IOUs that are issued by the U.S. Treasury. And we'll take a look at treasurydirect.gov, which is where the average Joe or Jane investor can buy Treasury bills at the same prices as the big boys and girls on Wall Street. Very cool website. And because we are interested in a better return than just 2 to 5%, we are going to look at the risk premium, the reward for bearing risk, the extra return on a risky asset over the risk-free rate of return. Now, this is from your book. It's a table that shows you if we just took Treasury bills, we're going to get over the last 80 years, now in the future, it's no guarantee, 3.7%, which is about what banks have paid over the last 80 years. And our premium is zero because we are accepting the risk-free rate of return. If we jump to large company, again, ignore small company stocks. If we jump to large company stocks, as much as people, you know, scream and holler about how horrible the world is, over the last 80 years, stocks have returned almost 12%. Now, what is this measure? It's the Standard & Poor's 500 Index. Now, what the hell is that? We'll discuss that in detail next chapter and in the next chapter. It's just a list of 500 stocks. So that's a huge premium, isn't it? If we accept the volatility of stocks, we're going to do a whole lot better than if we just put our money in the bank. Unless the world ends. In which case, it doesn't matter. Right? Because if the world ends, we're all dead. Now, bonds have done pretty well, but wouldn't you rather have the return, the risk premium from stocks, especially if you're younger? Once you get older, oh boy, you got to be careful because a major downturn like 2008 can destroy your nest egg in retirement. But for the young people, it makes sense for you to be invested wholly in stocks. And that's my personal opinion. Some other people are going to say, no, he doesn't understand. I understand all too well. Some people watch what happens, and then the first hint of a downturn, they take their money out at the worst possible moment and wait for the stock market to go back up 50% or 100% and put it back in. And that's the emotional side of investing. And I hope by the end of this course, you will understand that there is an intellectual side and there's an emotional side. And I'm going to give you some tools to deal with both. All right? All right. Now, it's up to you what you do with your money. But you millennials, if you were to come to me, I would recommend that you relax, breathe deeply, and hope that the market crashes. Later. Okay. Risk versus reward. Risk versus return. Do you want to eat well or do you want to sleep well? Investment return is very straightforward. How much did you start with? How much did you end with? That is your return. But measuring how much risk you took to receive that return is much more difficult. Each year, the investment community measures the average annual return and the amount of variance from the average return. Using statistics, I used that joke before, didn't I? The resulting measures of risk are called variance and standard deviation. And here's the formula. And don't worry, you don't have to do it. It's already done for us. But anybody take statistics? You remember variance, standard deviation? It's really not that hard, folks. We'll leave the calculations for your statistics class. But to suffice to say, as the variance and standard deviation go up, the more risky the investment. The more likely we're not going to get the average annual return in any one year. And if you want to take a look at the math, it's really not that hard. This means summation, right? You understand that? Because you use a spreadsheet, summation. And what we're doing is we're taking the return from any one year, from year one up to year 10 or 20 or whatever, and we're subtracting the average return. That's what the bar means. Go back and find the mean average. And then what you do is you square that. You take the difference and you square it. Why do you square it? Gets rid of the negative signs. Everything's positive. Then you take that number and divide it by the number of numbers minus one. So you take the sum and divide it by n minus 1. Why do you do that? Central limit theory of statistics. That's the variance. The standard deviation, then, you take the square root. You don't have to do it. You understand? If you want to, there are some exercises in the book. You can do it, but all you're going to do is you're going to look on the internet and it's going to tell you what the variance is. You understand? Because that's why we're investors. We're not statistics. I took a lot of statistics in class, in my undergrad years, believe it or not, and I love it, but we don't have to worry about it. This is the distribution of the returns on common stocks as measured by the Standard & Poor's 500 Index from 1926 to 2004. And what this means, for example, if the return was between 0 and 10, we put the year in this category. If the return was between 10 and 20, we put the year in this category. If the return was negative, you with me? Look at some years are pretty darn good, folks. 1958, 1935, 1928, 50% return? Doesn't happen too often, does it? And then some years, notice, 2001, 2002, 2008. Whew. You got to go back to the Great Depression to see a year when we lost more than 30%. Yes, George?
I was going to ask, why was it so high if it was just right after the Great Depression?
If the price gets really low, people start buying. If the price gets really high,
people were broke, people were poor.
That's right. And prices got so low. We can't get our hands around this because it's very difficult. But the Dow Jones Industrial Average went from, I forget exactly the numbers, it went from around 300 down to 28. They lost 89% from 1929 to 1932. You with me? I mean, some companies were literally just destroyed. You ever hear of Radio Corporation of America? Yes, you have. It's RCA. In 1929, it sold for $290, I think. I remember. I'm forgetting the numbers. By 1932, it sold for $2. So at that point, people who were smart started buying. After they got over their, as you said, they're terrified. They're very terrified. If the price gets low enough, what's going to happen? People are going to start buying. If the price gets high enough, people start selling. This is what when people complain about the price of oil. Anybody complaining about gasoline now? Are you complaining about gasoline? No, of course not, right? You're using more, aren't you? You're going to drive the price back up, you goofballs. What we should do, which we won't, is the United States should add a tax on gas to bring it back up to $3 a gallon, and then as the price goes up, which it will, goes back up to $3, they can lower the tax. We won't do that. Forget it. It won't happen. But when the price gets too high, what do people start doing? They cut back. They buy more fuel-efficient cars. They carpool. They drive fewer miles. You with me? So you, as a consumer, lower the price. When people say, the price is too high, I say, well, do you drive? They say, yeah. I say, well, it's because of you. Why is the price so high? It's because you're buying it. If you stop buying it, they'd lower the price. And that's exactly what happened, George. Does it make sense? Okay. Because after 2002, where's 2003? 2003. This is the history of capitalism. We can't find that golden mean. We're always going way over here, and then we're turning around going way over there. But does this thing remind you of anything, huh? That you may have seen. What does it remind you of? The standard deviation is the real, the normal curve, the standard curve, the bell curve, it's sometimes called, the normal distribution. Nature has been kind to us in many ways. In many statistical samplings of things that happen in nature, you get this bell curve. And it turns out that stock returns and bond returns and even short-term investment returns follow a normal curve. There is an average that we said was 8 to 12, 8 to 10. Notice that it's actually 11.7. So don't tell people that because that's pretty high. But I tell people 8, 9, 10%. But there's a huge range. And in the central limit theorem of statistics, if a population follows a normal distribution, then there is a two-thirds, 68%, about 66% chance that any one year you will be within one standard deviation. So sure, the average annual return has been 8, 9, 10, 11%, but in any one year, are you going to get 8, 9, 10, 11%? Probably not. You're going to get 17, minus 12, 4, 22. It's going to be all over the map. Make sense? If we go out two standard deviations, then we're a 95% chance. Three standard deviations, 99% chance. Make sense? You don't have to do this. You don't have to do this calculation. It's already done for us. And here from the books, and these are not very good graphs, by the way, because the size of these bars are all the same, but these bars would be much smaller, and these bars would be much larger. But the takeaway is that the more risky, the wider the distribution. The more likely you are to get 35%, minus 25%, 40%, minus 20, maybe zero. But as you go down the risk versus return spectrum, the standard deviation variance, the normal distribution variance, the height of the bell goes way up, and the width goes way short, way narrow. Make sense? Am I going too fast? Make sense, everybody? Yeah? Okay, good. Because you need to understand this. You need to understand this. Not that you have to do the calculations, you don't. Here's another graph that you may or may not like. It's up to you. The more the standard deviation, history shows us, the higher the return. So it's like that. If that helps, if not, don't worry about it. So we can go back to last Thursday and complete the picture of global view of risk versus return. Sure, Sweden did the best, didn't it? But let's take a look at the standard deviations. Who had the best risk-adjusted return? Who had the least amount of risk, as measured by standard deviation, which we know to be a horrible measurement? Who had the least amount of risk? Come on! Yay! There's a reason why our stock markets are coveted by the rest of the world. Because informed, intelligent investors know that, sure, you're not going to get as good as return to Sweden, but you're not going to have to deal with 60% more risk, as measured by standard deviation, which is an imperfect measurement. Make sense? So, hey! I have to think about these things, you know, I get you excited somehow. All right. So, does you got it yet, folks? Did you get it? Has it gone in here? I'm for Philadelphia. You want high returns? You're going to get high risk. You're going to lose some of your money, maybe all of your money. And if anybody tells you differently, they're lying. So when, not if, because if you get involved in investing, you're going to see these. When you see an advertisement for a 12% safe rate of return, you will know the chances of losing your money are pretty darn high. When you see claims of 300 or even 3,000%, and you will, believe it or not, there are people out there who just tell the biggest lie they can, and some people go, oh, I'm going to follow them. Sit on your hands and grab your wallet. Oh, by the way, they're breaking the law. And whose responsibility is it to go after them? The Securities and Exchange Commission. And what do? They send them a letter saying, stop that. Cease and desist letter. And they keep doing it, They send them another letter saying, we told you to stop that. And then they send them a third, and finally they leave and go somewhere else and start them another name. And so, do you believe me? Well, here's one I got on the website. And this is off of Yahoo, folks. I mean, so you know, it's not like these are they're out there. Look, Michael Parnes shows you how to trade like a pro. He turned 30, bud. You've seen this guy? $35,000 into $7 million in only 2 years. And why can he do it? Because he's bald. I calculated what he actually did, folks. He had a 1,356% return on his investment each year, or about 25% per month. Now, are you going to believe Mr. Parnes? Good, because you're going to see these. And some people do. Some people get suckered into these things. So you've got to be careful. But isn't somebody doing it? Isn't somebody making tremendous rates of return? Yes, there are people doing this, but they are not investors. We need to make that distinction. I lost this video. I should have stolen it. I don't like to steal videos off the internet, but Forbes had it on there, and then they just let it fall away. Where Mr. Bogle from he started Vanguard, he said, you have to decide, are you a trader? And I hate using that word because I always say it as if traitor, but trader with a D. Are you a trader, a speculator, as what we were, you know, what we were saying, Ricardo? Are you trying to buy it at 10 and sell it at 12 or 10 or 20 or whatever? Or are you an investor? Are you somebody who's patient and willing to allow your investment to grow over time? Traders are not investors. Oh, this is one, he was a very famous trader, a very famous speculator. The speculator is not an investor. His object is not to secure a steady return on his money at a good rate of interest or reward. I would use the word reward. But to profit by either a rise or a fall, in the price of whatever he may be speculating in. Being a trader can be very profitable, but it is also very stressful and very perilous. And you're up against the best in the world. How many people have ever tried to hit a fastball at 70 miles an hour? And how was it? Pretty darn scary, right? Well, how'd you do? What? Oh, softball's even faster sometimes, isn't it? Yeah, so she can do it. Softball is sometimes over 100 miles an hour. Is that true? Am I right? No, yeah. Some softballers can throw the ball faster than hardballers because they use that underarm. Well, some softballers are supposed to. I'm not a baseball fan. He's a baseball fan. He knows. Okay, but still, you move into the major leagues and it ain't 70. What is it? 95, 100? Can you do that? Because if you can, you can make a lot of money. And if you can buy something at a low $10, sell for $12, and then do it again the next day, you can make a whole lot of money, and you can be a trader. I can't help you. Because I can't do it. I'm not even going to try. But I can help you be a long-term prudent investor. Yes?
Does college offer trader classes?
Mm-mm. No, we don't. And I'll point you in a few directions if you're interested in learning. But I don't know any university that actually does. That's a good question.
Is it illegal?
No, it's not illegal. Well, it depends. Unless it's gambling, isn't it? We don't use that term. We don't say gambling. No, it's speculative.
Are you gambling with other people's money, though?
Well, you can, but normally you're gambling with your own. But there's a way to do it with other people's money. And then you get the big job on Wall Street, and some people crack, and some people don't, and some people make tons of money and buy a boat and get in trouble with the SEC because they have insider trading, which is legal. So, question, do you want to be an investor or a speculator? We can help you learn how to be a patient, prudent, successful, long-term investor. We cannot help you become a successful short-term speculator. Sorry. And what I want to give you is a little five-minute story. So please indulge me, because this is a very cool story about a very famous speculator by the name of John Merriweather. He worked for a firm, Salomon Brothers. Now, this is in the 1980s, folks, so the little numbers are a little not quite exactly the same. But Salomon Brothers has now been subsumed into Citigroup, I think, eventually, because it's not around anymore. But it was one of the biggest bond trading firms on the Wall Street. And the boss was John Goodfreund, which is German for good friend. So I'll try to say good friend, because Goodfreund is a little hard for me to say. And that was the boss. The trader was John Merriweather. On sometime early in 1986, our chairman, John Goodfriend, left his desk at the head of the trading floor and went for a walk. At any given moment on the trading floor, billions of dollars were being risked by drawn traders. Goodfriend took the pulse of the place by simply wandering around and asking questions. An eerie sixth sense guided him to wherever a crisis was unfolding. Goodfriend seemed able to smell money being lost. And he talked about how he would terrorize the other traders, and he would just scare the living daylights out of people, and he was considered the king of Wall Street. But this day, however, he did something strange. Instead of terrifying us all, he walked a straight line to the trading desk of John Merriweather, a member of the board of Salomon, and also Solomon's finest bond trader. He whispered a few words. The traders in the vicinity eavesdropped. What Goodfriend said has become a legend at Salomon Brothers and a visceral part of its corporate identity. He said, "One hand, $1 million, no tears." Merriweather grabbed the meaning instantly. The King of Wall Street, as Business Week had dubbed Goodfriend, wanted to play a single hand of a game called Liar's Poker for $1 million. He played the game most afternoons with Merriweather and his accomplices and was usually skinned alive. The peculiar feature of this challenge was the size of the stake. Normally, the bets never exceeded a few hundred dollars. Now, you have to understand, in New York, going out to lunch is $50-$60. A dinner is $200. So a few hundred dollars for them is, you know, is like $20-$30 to us. Not a big deal. The final two words of his challenge, no tears, meant that the loser was expected to suffer a great deal of pain, but wasn't entitled to whine, bitch, or moan about it. He'd have to hunker down and keep his poverty to himself. But why? You might ask, if any other one than the King of Wall Street, why do it in the first place? Why in particular challenge Merriweather? He was the king of the game. Okay, what is Liar's Poker? Liar's Poker is a game where you take out a dollar bill and you look at the dollar bill and you look at the serial numbers. And then 2, 5, 10, up to 10 people around in a circle all do the same. And what you do is you start bidding. You say 3 sixes. And what you're saying is, in all the dollar bills that we have, there are 3 sixes in all the serial numbers. And then the next person says 3 sevens or 4 sixes. They have to bid higher. The bidding escalates until all players agree to challenge a single player's bid. Then and only then do the players reveal their serial numbers and determine who is bluffing whom. In the midst of all this, the mind of a good player spins with probabilities. What is the statistical likelihood of there being 3 sixes within a batch of, say, 40 randomly number-generated serial numbers? For a great player, however, the math is trivial. It's the easy part. The hard part is reading the faces of the other players. The complexity arrives when all players know how to bluff and double bluff. The game has the feel of trading, just as jousting has some of the feel of war. The question a Liar's Poker player asks himself are, up to a point, the same questions a bond trader asks himself. Is this a smart risk? Do I feel lucky? How cunning is my opponent? Does he have any idea what he's doing? If not, how do I exploit his ignorance? If he bids high, is he bluffing, or does he really have a strong hand? Is he trying to induce me to make a foolish bid? Or does he actually have 4 of a kind himself? Every player seeks weaknesses, predictability, and a pattern in the others and seeks to avoid it in himself. The bond traders of all the Wall Street firms played it, but it was the stakes ran the highest, thanks to John Merriweather, at Salomon Brothers. The code of the Liar's Poker player was something like the code of a gunslinger. It required a trader to accept all challenges. Because of the code, which was his code, Merriweather felt obliged to play. But he knew it was stupid. For him, there was no upside. If he won, he upset his boss. No good came of this. But if he lost, he was out of pocket $1 million. That was worse than upsetting the boss. Although Merriweather was by far the better player of the game, in a single game, anything could happen. He well determined the outcome. Merriweather spent his entire day avoiding dumb bets, and he wasn't about to accept this one. "No, John," he said. "If we're going to play for those kind of numbers, I'd rather play for real money. $10 million, one hand, no tears." What did he just do? Yeah, he just said, okay, $10 million. Go from one to ten. $10 million! Now, you remember, put out another zero because it's 2015. It was a moment for all the players to savor. Merriweather was playing liar's poker before the game even started. He was bluffing. He didn't have the $10 million. Good friend countered the proposal. It would have been just like him to accept. Merely to entertain the thought was a luxury that must have pleased him well. It was good to be rich. But on the other hand, $10 million was and is a lot of money. If he lost, he'd only have about $30 million or so left, and his wife, Susan, was busy spending the better part of $15 million redecorating their Manhattan apartment. Merriweather knew this. And as good friend was the boss, he clearly wasn't bound by the Merriweather code. Maybe the whole point of his challenge was just to judge Merriweather's response. So, good friend declined. He smiled his own brand of forced smile and says, "You're crazy." "No," thought Merriweather and all the bond traders on the Solomon Brothers trading floor, "just very, very good." So, are you ready to go up against John Merriweather? Hmm? I ain't. Did you like that story? Yeah, good, 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 good. So, what is a realistic return for me? We're almost done. It's a 5-minute warning. After you have taken this course, you will have a strong knowledge of the most popular types of investments. Stocks, bonds, cash, mutual funds. You will also know what levels of return, what levels of risk you should reasonably expect to receive. And if you are a patient, long-term investor, I believe it is realistic to expect 8 to 10%. I am certainly working on it myself, and as of yesterday, it was over 10%, and that's over 20-some-odd years. Of course, as we will reiterate time and time again, there are no guarantees. Okay, is that good enough? Is 8, 9, 10% good enough? Yes. No. For Daniel, no. Who else? Who said no? Who else said no? For Daniel, no. Daniel wants a billion. Can't do that. Who else? Anybody else say? Yeah, it turns out it is. If we got to ask a few questions here. If you're young and start early, if you are patient and consistent, if you do not get cocky or greedy, if you do not chase after the next big thing when it comes along, and most importantly, no, this is bold, you don't panic when the market swoons, because it's going to happen. History tells us. People will say, "Are we going to have a crash?" I say, "Yeah." They go, "Oh, when's it going to happen?" "I don't know." "Yeah, I mean, if I do, you think I'd tell you?" Yeah, yeah.
You're still a Gen Xer like me, and you're not.
You still have plenty of time. Half a sandwich is better than no sandwich, right? Yeah, exactly. The trick is to take advantage of the time value of money compound and return. The time value of money. We will not do those calculations. I'll show you them if we have a couple minutes. But we do them in the 121 class. The amount to which a sum you invest now will increase based on a specified rate of return and time period. It's also called compounding. We're going to do the other one. We're going to do present value later on. We're going to go from the future back to the present. But the news is good. So instead of doing the exercises, I'm going to show you on the website is a worksheet, and some of you have taken the Business 121. It should look familiar. It's good old bend over, I lean forward, and kneel down. Okay, so you remember them? And the truth is, if you start early and you put 50, 100 bucks or more, if you have it, into a good long-term stock-oriented, equity-oriented investment, unless the world ends, Ebola becomes the rage, meteorite hits, disco returns, whatever, some horrible tragedy happens, you should do well. you should be able to amass $1.4 million or $2 million. Not a billion, sorry. You gotta start your own business, Daniel. Questions, thoughts? Okay, we're almost done. One last comment on risk versus return. One of the things that we want to do, especially in the short term, it's going to happen over the long term. You're going to have a big reduction. But we want to avoid large losses. Let's say you have $100. The first year, you get 85% return on your investment. Whoopee! 10. Second year, 50% loss, 9% up. Which one do you want? People will choose A because they see 85, 50. I'm still 30%. No, it doesn't work that way. The numbers don't work the same going down as they do going up. Sure, we have $185 the first year, $110 the second. You see what a 50% loss will do to you? But the chances are you're going to experience maybe not 50, but 30, 40, maybe more. I don't know. We'll see. Hope to live long enough for it to happen. But I don't want to be fully invested in stocks when it does because I'm getting older. Now, before we embark on the process of identifying and familiarizing ourselves with longer-term, higher-yielding investments, let us learn how and where to park our money using short-term investments. But first, one more time, the greater the variance and standard deviation of the average annual returns, the greater the risk, the more volatile, the lesser the risk, the less volatile. There is no correlation, no relationship, or standard what? I always hated statistics. Don't get this one wrong on the exam. You understand? It's bad for my self-esteem. Okay? I think I said it wrong. Okay, so next Thursday, you don't want to miss Thursday, because we will cover short-term investments. Those of you who want to add to class, come on up if you're late. And we will work together to make a portfolio for this semester. All right, so see you on Thursday, folks. Study, study hard. Bring honor and glory to Southwestern Community College.